Okay, so we have a constitution. I'd just like to kind of hit some, before we actually go into the constitution and start studying that, I'd like to hit some kind of some wrap-up points here at this point. Right after the constitution was signed, John Adams stormed into King George's vicar's office and dropped the new constitution on his desk, and he said, "Here, now we're a nation." And the king was still reluctant to negotiate, but as you recall, starting in 1215 with the Magna Carta, they always backed off on their commitments and so forth. A second really critical issue, in 1803, we had the Louisiana Purchase, which was 829,000 square miles that we purchased for $15 million and doubled the size of the United States. And Napoleon needed the money to carry on his war with Britain. So again, the warring between Britain and France and Spain, we were kind of an offshoot, but in this case, it really benefited us. And we talked last week about getting Florida. We traded it. We traded Havana to Spain to get Florida into the continental United States. And there again, that was based on the war with Spain and Britain. Now, all of these events led to the War of 1812. I'm jumping ahead here, but the rest of the time we're going to be spending in the Constitution, so I don't know exactly where to put this. But the War of 1812 was called the Second War of Independence, and basically Britain was trying to retake naval dominance and to retake the United States. They tried to capture New Orleans, New York. They started to burn Washington and to retake Baltimore. We all have heard about the fighting at Fort McHenry, which led to the Star-Spangled Banner being written. That was in the War of 1812. And now, another issue on the War of 1812, James Madison, when he was president, proclaimed two national days of prayer in 1812 and 1813. On August 25th, 1814, as the British burned the White House, Capitol, and public buildings, dark clouds began to roll in. A tornado sent debris flying, blew off roofs, and knocked chimneys over on top of British troops. Two cannons were lifted off the ground and dropped yards away. A British historian wrote, "More British soldiers were killed by this stroke of nature than from all the firearms the American troops had mustered. British forces fled in confusion and rains extinguished the fires." Madison then proclaimed a national day of public humiliation, fasting, and prayer to Almighty God on November 16th, 1814. And 2 weeks after the war ended, Madison proclaimed a national day of thanksgiving and a devout acknowledgement to Almighty God on March 4th, 1815. And there was one other address that really speaks to the place of Christianity and morality in our country, and it was in George Washington's farewell address. I believe it was after he was president. "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness. And let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. Whatever may be conceded to the influence of refined education, reason, and experience, both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principle." So again, foundation on faith, and that's what pulled this country through the War of 1812, just as it did the other previous ones. Okay, so let's delve into the Constitution. We're at the bottom of your page 31. Governor Morris set forth the six main purposes of good government for the first time in political history when he wrote the preamble of the Constitution. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The preamble is a wonderfully succinct introduction to the content of the Constitution, and every American should learn it by heart. It is easy to memorize by using sign language while reciting it. Okay. Now, one of the most important provisions of the Constitution is Article 1, Section 1, which reads, "All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives." This gave the people the right not to be subject to any federal law unless it has been reviewed and approved by a majority of the people's representatives. Now, gradually the executive and judicial branches of the government began to usurp this authority in the following ways. The executive branch began making laws by issuing executive orders and publishing them as new laws in the Federal Register. Now, we can blame the president for that, but at the same time, we can blame the Congress for that, because the Congress has every right, when the president writes an executive order, for the Congress to say, all right, let's review and vote on that. They have that right to approve or to disapprove. It's strictly cowardice that they just let these things stand without taking a stand on them. They have never challenged an executive order that I've been able to find. Well, George Washington wrote some executive orders, but they were well within his authority to administer the executive branch of the government.
Correct.
And he wrote a dozen executive orders for the executive branch. I think every president has written some executive orders. Now, I don't have a whole lot of data on Lincoln, but when we get to Article 2, we'll find that the president has six specific granted responsibilities. Six. I think he's using a little more than those today. Now, the presidents in the 19th century honored what the Constitution said that they could do. They honored the fact that the Constitution gave them six specific responsibilities that they had authority to perform, until Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt, early in the 20th century, reinterpreted the Constitution. He said that he could do anything that the Constitution did not say that he couldn't do. Okay? So he was the first president to really misuse executive orders. And he issued 1,060 executive orders. They regulated business. He resolved a coal strike, called it the Square Deal. And he had a lot to do with conservation. Now, it's interesting to me that in a whole lot of areas, we'll read about Teddy Roosevelt being a hero, but he was really the first real progressive to abuse this power. Now, in the area of conservation, by executive order, he took a lot of land. He founded 5 national parks, 150 national forests, 18 national monuments, and 51 wildlife refuges. So the amount of land that was essentially owned by the federal government under Teddy Roosevelt went from 42 million acres to 172 million acres. Now, I like the national parks, I like the national monuments, and I think we all do, but the point is he did not have the authority to do that under the Constitution. You know, I think it's nice that we have national parks. I'm not saying that we should close them down or anything like that, but that it was outside of the purvey. The president was authorized to set up certain types of regulatory agencies, and these bodies immediately began issuing thousands of orders that were treated as laws which could be enforced in the courts. This kind of regulation is called administrative law. And last week, we called it ruler's law, which in truth it is. Just think about where we're at today with cap and trade not being able to be passed by the Congress, so let's pull it in under EPA as a carbon pollutant and so forth. The president also began to involve the nation in many new legal obligations with foreign powers by entering into extensive and sometimes secretive executive agreements. According to the Constitution, foreign commitments should be handled through treaties approved by the Senate. The Supreme Court has also created numerous new laws under the guise of merely interpreting old ones. This was particularly true during the administration of Chief Justice Earl Warren in 54 to 69. This is called judicial legislation. Okay. Any comments? Now, I also, any comments or questions on any of that? Well, if you write a law that negates an executive order and that new law is found to be constitutional in the courts, it supersedes the previous law. Okay, let's go to page 33. Article 1. The states delegate 20 powers to Congress. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States, but all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. In connection with the taxing power, this clause states that revenues can only be expended for the general welfare of the whole nation as it carries out the list of duties set forth. These funds are not to be spent for individuals, special groups, or particular geographical locations. This clause was designed by the founders to be a limitation on the taxing power of the Congress. Let's talk about that a little bit. The general welfare clause is very important. What does the general welfare mean? That the Congress can collect taxes for the welfare of everyone, not for education, not for poverty groups, but they can only legislate taxes for the common good. The General Welfare Clause is mentioned in the Constitution twice, first in the preamble and second in Article 1, Section 8 that we just read. When the Founding Fathers said that we the people established the Constitution to promote the general welfare, they did not mean the federal government would have the power to aid education, build roads, and subsidize business. The Founding Fathers said in the preamble that one reason for establishing the Constitution was to promote the general welfare. What they meant was that the Constitution and powers granted to the federal government were not to favor special interest groups or particular classes of people. There were to be no privileged individuals or groups in society. Neither minorities nor the majority was to be favored. Rather, the Constitution would promote the general welfare by ensuring a free society where free, self-responsible individuals, rich and poor, bankers and shopkeepers, employers and employees, farmers and blacksmiths would enjoy life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. rights expressed in the Declaration of Independence. Quoting the 10th Amendment, Jefferson wrote, "I consider the foundation of the Constitution as laid on this ground, that all powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states or to the people to take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power no longer susceptible of any definition. It leaves to the states the issues of how or when other services are provided to specific subgroups. However, and this is critical, the new government must represent the best interests of all the people, which logically means that it must be limited in scope. For the more a government undertakes, the more oppressive it becomes." The founders warned that the looting of one group of citizens for the benefit of another group is assigning to government a power which individual citizens do not have the authority to assign. They can only assign to government what they can rightfully do themselves, and looting one neighbor for the benefit of another would be considered a crime. In the 5,000-year leap, they talk... Huh? Exactly. They talk about a man having two neighbors. One had two cars, the other one had no cars, and so the well-intentioned guy went and hot-wired one of the two cars and gave it to his neighbor and ended up in prison. But the point being that so then he did it under he got the city council to approve a law that they ought to be able to give this other guy's car to the needy neighbor. But the point is we cannot authorize the government to do something that is not within our authority to do on our own. So if I'm not allowed to go and take a neighbor's car and give it to somebody else, neither is the city. Okay? So we cannot authorize the government to do something that we don't have the authority to do ourselves. Well, the Constitution guarantees equal rights, equal opportunities, not equal things. So the General Welfare Clause is very important as we see a lot of the things that we've done to the Constitution over the last century. Back in the middle of page 33, when Alexander Hamilton became Secretary of the Treasury under Washington, he argued that this clause was a general grant of power which allowed Congress to tax and spend money for any good cause, regardless of whether it was among the enumerated powers or whether it was for local or special welfare rather than general welfare. He had never presented this idea at the Constitutional Convention, where it would have been immediately rejected because it torpedoed the whole idea of a limited government. Hamilton was immediately opposed by Jefferson and Madison, who emphasized the original intent of the founders in having the national government carry out its assignment in ways that would benefit the nation as a whole, not special groups or special regions. One of the other interesting things here is we can see that political strife has been a part of this nation since its founding, basically. Hamilton was a Federalist, and Jefferson was what they called a Democratic Republican at the time. And there was always this issue of the strength of the federal government versus the individual and states' rights, on the other hand. And it was fought over, and people were vilified in the press and everything back in those days, just like they are today. In fact, the whole issue of people saying that Thomas Jefferson fathered children by one of his slaves was just that type of an issue. An over-aggressive reporter, who wasn't a reporter, he was a sensationalist, started that, and there's a whole lot of information about that, and we can discuss it in more detail if you would like. But my point is the contention between the factions of government have been since day one, and in fact, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were very close and worked together in getting the Constitution together, but Adams was a Federalist and Jefferson, as I said, was a Democratic Republican. Adams became the second president, and he actually initiated the Alien and Sedition Acts while he was president, and people that spoke against the government were imprisoned under the Alien and Sedition Acts. And of course, when Jefferson became the third president, those acts were just nullified and taken away. But I guess my point is, we get real tired of the political bickering, but it isn't anything new.
I know all about bickering.
Do you? Would you like to share a little bit?
No.
No.
No, thank you. He doesn't.
You just heard about it at dinner, right? Okay. The founders' original intent generally prevailed until 1936, when the Supreme Court virtually amended the Constitution by a judicial opinion in the Butler case. Justice Roberts was joined by four other justices in handing down a dictum that thereafter Congress could follow Hamilton's doctrine of taxing and spending money for any cause it considered beneficial. 1936. Let's see, who was in the White House at that point in time? The Judicial Reorganization Bill of 1937. Now, basically, the Supreme Court was not favorable to many of the New Deal policies and was against them, which really limited FDR in what he was able to do or what he was not able to do. Now, his solution was to pack the court, and he, under the leadership of the Senate Majority Leader Joseph T. Robinson, they put together a bill to stack the court. And the way that was going to be done is the bill granted the president power to appoint an additional justice to the U.S. Supreme Court up to a maximum of six for every sitting member over the age of 70 and a half. FDR was preparing this through the Senate, and meanwhile the Supreme Court was going back and forth as to where they would stand on the New Deal programs. Now, before the new law was introduced, Justice Owen Roberts joined the wing of the bench more sympathetic to the New Deal. He had previously ruled against most New Deal legislation. Now, FDR's initiative failed due to adverse public opinion. The country didn't like this court stacking idea, and by the sudden death of the bill's champion in the Senate, Majority Leader Joseph T. Robinson. So, at that point in time, that is where the Supreme Court allowed a lot of these progressive New Deal issues to be implemented through the legislature. This unconstitutional dictum opened the floodgates of the U.S. Treasury to virtually unlimited political looting, with the following results. Federal budgets rose from a little over $6 billion in 1936 to more than $3.5 trillion in 2010. Okay. Now, one other issue is that Article 1, Section 8, Clause 2 says that Congress shall have the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States. There are two factors that seriously damage the credit of any government: excessive debt and unstable currency due to inflation. What this really means is that by indulging in wild deficit spending each year, the present generation of Americans has been squandering almost $1 trillion of the next generation's inheritance. No other generations of Americans has ever done this to its children before. The founders called this exploitation of the next generation immoral. In a very real sense, it is for the next generation taxation without representation. As Jefferson said, we shall all consider ourselves unauthorized to saddle posterity with our debts and morally bound to pay them ourselves, and consequently, within what may be deemed the period of a generation or the life expectancy of the majority. So that was Thomas Jefferson's opinion on debt. The credit of the United States can also be seriously damaged if it pays off its debts with money which has been cheapened by inflation or quantitative easing, what is it, QE3, QE2? Quantitative easing, right. So today we have a national debt of $14 trillion, over $14 trillion, 320 million people. So every baby born into this country is $44,000 in debt on the day they're born. Yes. Page 34, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3. Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Interstate commerce. The regulation of interstate commerce has been one of the most distorted and abused provisions of the entire Constitution. Interpretations of this clause have passed through several stages to ensure the free flow of commerce among the several states, with emphasis on commerce rather than regulation. Or in the beginning, that's what it was, to ensure free flow of commerce. The regulation of transportation under B, not the production or sale of goods and services going interstate. Okay, that was what was delegated.
What was that?
Our item B, the power delegated by the states to the national government was intended to be limited to the regulation of transportation, not the production or sale of goods and services going interstate. Under the pressure of war and depression, the Supreme Court twisted or reversed traditional cases on interstate commerce and introduced the unconstitutional doctrine that the federal government may regulate anything that affects interstate commerce directly or indirectly. This has resulted in usurpation of power in the form of sweeping federal regulations over intrastate transportation of goods, labor disputes, price controls, and federal controls on any industry involved directly or indirectly in the nationwide current of commerce. Okay, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5. Congress shall have the power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. The power to coin money as a constitutional directive meant that the United States must always be on a gold and silver standard. In Section 10, we see that the states are forbidden to pay debts in anything but gold and silver. However, the courts eventually allowed the government to print paper money to replace the notes being issued by thousands of banks. Even so, the courts originally ruled that the government currency had to be redeemable in gold or silver. To regulate the value thereof originally referred to the value of coins, but in 1913, Woodrow Wilson, the management of American money and credit was turned over to a consortium of private banks called the Federal Reserve System. This should have been considered unconstitutional, but the Supreme Court upheld it. In 1933, the United States was taken off the domestic gold standard, Franklin Roosevelt, without a constitutional amendment. All gold had to be turned into the U.S. Treasury except that used for jewelry, dentistry, or industry. In return for the gold, Americans received silver certificates. In 1964, Lyndon Johnson, the government went off the silver standard and Federal Reserve notes, which could no longer be redeemed in gold or silver, became legal tender. And finally, in 1971, under Richard Nixon, the government even refused to redeem with gold the paper dollars owned by foreigners. The American dollar immediately became a floating currency and has been dropping radically in buying power ever since. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15. Congress, rather than the president, was empowered to call up the militia of the various states. The federal code states that every male 17 to 44 years of age is subject to call as a member of the militia of his state. Congress can call up the militia for three purposes: to suppress insurrections, to repel an invasion by a foreign power, and to execute the laws of the United States. So, what other significant thing do we know about, what else in the Constitution talks about the militia? The Second Amendment. Under the Second Amendment, basically we're all members of the militia, and that's what it assures the right to keep and bear arms. Okay, it's 22 after. Okay, we'll finish this last up through the end of page 36. The federal government was also authorized by the Constitution to occupy certain areas within a state if such areas were purchased by the consent of the state legislature. The Constitution spelled out the purposes for which the federal government was authorized to make these purchases. Land could be purchased with the consent of the state legislature for the erection of forts, for magazines and arsenals, for dockyards, for other needful buildings, such as post offices. The first new state added to the Union was Ohio, which was admitted in 1803. Instead of giving the state all the public lands, the federal government sold them to help pay off the national debt. Ownership was thereby privatized and immediately went on the tax rolls of the state. This procedure was followed in all of the new states east of the Mississippi, as well as all the new states in the Louisiana Purchase. However, these provisions were completely ignored when the western states were admitted to the Union. The federal government unconstitutionally withheld vast sections of each state. The government still holds the following percentages of land in the western states. Look at Alaska at 69%, Nevada at 85%. Yeah, right. Okay, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4, Restrictions on Delegated Powers. Congress was prohibited from assessing a head tax or other direct tax, such as an income tax, on the states unless it was uniformly assessed according to the population of each state. It was this restriction that made the 16th Amendment necessary in order to tax on the basis of individual wealth.